Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractors Business Presentation of the Month. This monthly CV web series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of teaching contractors how to run profitable businesses. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry shares dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. Well, it starts before you even get to the office. The cell phone begins to ring, and once you arrive at the office, the pace picks up. Employees are talking with you about everything from their weekend trip to the mountains to the upset customer that called just before you arrived. The fax machine starts ringing. Your email box is full, and your desk is stacked with paper asking for your immediate attention. Information is everywhere. In fact, today, we are in a constant state of information overload. Well, there is good news, but unfortunately, it comes in the form of more information. This month's speaker, Jeff Davidson, has devoted much of his life to becoming the work-life balance expert for our time-pressed workforce. Jeff has written numerous books, including Breathing Space, 60-Second Self-Starter, The 60-Second Organizer, Joy of Simple Living, and Complete Idiot's Guide to Managing Your Time. Jeff also travels the country presenting keynote speeches and seminars on topics like no time, no clarity, no problem, managing information and communication overload, and choosing when it's confusing. Even though this month's presentation actually increases the information you're receiving, we believe it might just help put a little more order in your day. So do yourself a favor, find a quiet spot, and simply listen to Jeff's presentation. If it will make even a little more order in your day, therefore reducing your stress level a bit, it will have been worth it.
Surviving information overload. When you were growing up in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, or the 70s, and possibly a few listeners in the 80s, early 80s, did you ever believe that sometime in the future you would be bombarded by information all the time, all day long, from every direction? I certainly didn't. I remember when I was just before my first year in graduate school, I went to Europe. I visited the island of Minorca off the coast of Spain. I decided to take a tour around the island, and in about an hour, I was besieged by three wild dogs. The dogs came upon me. All I had was a bathing suit and a towel, and I thought they were going to pounce on me. There was no help around. Every place I turned, nobody, nothing. Each of the dogs was showing me their teeth, their grizzled coat. They were in that pre-pounce mode, and I saw myself as chopped meat. Finally, a man came running down the hill, and one by one, he took the dogs by the collar, brought them over to the side of the road, and there for the first time, I could see a gate. It was covered with vines. He put the dogs in the vines one by one, and then I realized I was going to get out of this predicament. But it strikes me to this day, here I was confronted by these hounds of, well, from wherever. And we're all confronted by hounds of too much information, hounds of too much to do, hounds of too much to read, hounds of time pressure, hounds of stress, every place we turn. Now, what you may not have realized is the pressure that people feel today is much less because of their individual management or personal styles when compared to sociocultural, big words, sociocultural factors. In other words, the culture in which we live accounts for much of the information overload and the time pressure that we all experience. Even though our individual jobs are demanding, we're continually asked to do more with fewer resources and so on. The reality of our existence today is that nobody really feels like they're keeping up. No one feels great about the daily deluge of information. No one is sure how to manage everything that's competing for their time and attention. And no one wants to admit not having all the answers, not being on top of things all the time, feeling as if, you know, they're chasing the clock. I'm here to tell you that this is a socially pervasive phenomenon. And indeed, as Western technology spreads throughout the globe, as other countries have their cell phones, their PCs, their fax machines, their email, their traffic, all the tie-ups, all the publication, you begin to wonder if the world is having a nervous breakdown with too much information. Now, a quick history lesson as to where we are and where we're going. The first great age that defined how people essentially made their livelihood was the age of hunting and gathering. People gathered berries, they hunted wild animals, they lived in small groups, roamed from place to place depending on the vegetation and the game, and this is primarily how they made their way. The next great age was the age of agriculture. Larger families, working the fields, predictable crop yields most years, and now and then the corn didn't rise so high, and every now and then people got into problems because there wasn't enough to go around, enough food. But nevertheless, most people were agrarian. The third great age was the age of industry, capital, production, consumers, producers. And most people began to move from the farm to the factory, from the rural to the urban. Every now and then you got your finger caught in the machine, but hey, essentially the age of industry carried us for many, many decades, even more than a century. Now we're about to embark on the age of information. And I say embark on the age of information. Here's the rub. We're not there yet. A lot of people have said, well, age of computer, age of information, age of the internet, call it whatever you want, but we're not actually there. If we were there, we would not be experiencing such tremendous time pressure, stress, and information overload on a continuous basis. If we were truly in the age of information, it would be analogous to Star Trek. You've all seen some version of Star Trek at one time or another, right? Okay, I see everyone is nodding heads. All right, good. In Star Trek, does anybody walk around with a software disk? Does anybody have an instruction book? Does anybody bring in a debugger, a programmer? Does anybody have to go through any of this stuff we do today? When they want information, what do they do on Star Trek? That's right. They talk to the wall. They say, computer, give me all the information on planet Delta 32. And in a nice, friendly voice, the computer does what? Either gives them the answer or asks them something more. You know, give me more information, ask your question in a different way, whatever. But within the span of a minute or two in a couple sentences, primarily anybody on the Starship Enterprise can get the answer to the information they want. That, my friends, is the age of information. That is the age in which we're freed from carrying this stuff, freed from having to stay on top of everything all the time because the technology works almost invisibly. I'll give you an example from the age of industry. The lighting in your office, in your home, is a prime example of the age of industry at its finest. In order to turn on the lights, you don't have to be a chemical engineer, an electrical engineer, a structural engineer. You don't have to know about ohms, joules, watts, resistance, anything. All you have to do is flip on the lights and they come on 99.999% of the time. So it will be someday regarding the age of information, but we're simply not there yet. For now, there's going to be a lot of pain and gnashing of teeth. So to recapitulate, nobody feels like they're keeping up. And it doesn't matter if you're the president, the king, the queen, prime minister, if you have a PhD, if you're a Nobel laureate, anyone can be overwhelmed by mid-morning. You can be away for 7 days, come back on that first Monday, and by 10 in the morning, you can feel it hit you. All the emails, all the faxes, everything in your in-bin, everybody clamming for your attention. I did a study in 1990. I redid it several times since. In 1990, I found out that more information... Are you all sitting down? All right. More information was generated in 24 hours back in 1990 than you could take in, you could comfortably ingest in the rest of your life. Even if you're 20 years old and you live to be 100, 80 more years, you could not take in 80 years the amount of information generated in one day on Earth in 1990. Now, that seems pretty overwhelming, but by 1996, 1 minute's worth of information generated on Earth exceeded your lifetime intake capacity. By 1999, 1 second's worth of information generated on Earth exceeded your lifetime's intake capacity. And today, it's a fraction of a second and falling. So that tells you right there that no one has a lock on what's coming down the pike. No one feels particularly comfortable with the volume of information they're being hit with on a regular basis. Fortunately, there are things we can do to take control. We're going to get to those in a very short minute or two. So, the depth of your comprehension absolutely is challenged as more information hits you on a daily basis, more information per hour. Everyone faces the same phenomenon. More than 200 years ago, the great French philosopher Voltaire said, "The multitude of books is making us ignorant." And yet, today, worldwide, we face a situation where, once again, are you sitting down? 2,000 books are published at a minimum every week in the United States. Sometimes 3,000 books. Around the world, it's more than 1,000 books a day. 1,000 books a day. The cultural symptoms of overload are all around us. The Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., some of you are located in Washington, last year added another 1 million items to its collection, even though it's been in business for more than 150 years. Like in the first 150 years, they didn't already have millions of things that they entered. They found 1 million more things to enter in the last year alone. The English language, if you will, has added more than 60,000 words since the end of the 1960s. Now, to put this in perspective, 60,000 words is equal to half of most of the other languages in the world. It's just about half the number of total words in French or Spanish or Italian. The English language has more than 400,000 words, closer to 450,000 words, as we have borrowed from everyone in our scientific, technical, computer terms, keep upping the number of words that one has to know in the English language. As a matter of fact, think about the technology-driven terminology that pretty much defines the workplace today. I mean, you have to know about things such as snail mail and web surfing. You have to know about burnout and spamming. You've probably heard of email jail, telephone tag, multitasking. Dozens and dozens of words and terms concocted in our society every week. And then, of course, the media. Television shows, radio, the web. Do you know that the number of TV shows available in a single month, if you have one of these cable systems or Star Channel or any other type of satellite, exceeds 60,000? The number of new magazines generated in the United States in a single year, more than 1,000. The number of publications available at any given time, more than 12,000. So here's a quiz question for you, because we're going to move right now into solutions. In India, what is in jeopardy when massive rain results in a flood? The answer is the water supply. The water supply. When you have too much competing for your time and attention, when you're hit by too much information, what is in jeopardy? your ability to use information. So we have to begin to realize right now that there are structural limits to how much we can take in, how much we can do, and we have to make hard choices as to where we give our time and attention. If I started stacking bricks on a table, I'm sure everyone would agree there is an upward limit as to how many bricks we could stack. It might be the ceiling level, or if we were outside, it might be how much weight the table could bear. Eventually, the bricks would fall over. Eventually, the table would collapse. So, too, we have to realize that there are temporal limits. 168 hours in a week. Only so many hours we can put in at work. Only so much we can give our time and attention to. And so that tells us right there, we have to make hard decisions. We have to have the mental and emotional strength to focus on the most important issues and be able to let go of the peripheral issues, the side items, the nice but not necessary kind of stuff. So, I'm going to spare you. We're going to skip the quiz that I have listed in the next block because it would be more work for you than it's worth. We have to realize that paper in and of itself sometimes becomes a roadblock. I've spoken to groups such as America Online, IBM, others who you might think would have the paper beast mastered. But you know what? They tell me, no, we're besieged by paper just like everyone else. Everybody's copying things and recipes and Little League schedules and CCing each other. They're using the fax machine. They're using the printer. Paper everywhere. Onslaught at work and at home. Two major factors account for why there's so much paper in our society. Number one, we have the lowest postal rates, if you can believe it. Lowest postal rates, which has spawned a huge direct mail industry. And that tells you right there about the importance of getting your name and the names of others in your firm off of lists. You want to stop at the top the paper from coming into your company to begin with when you don't need to have those publications. So the first factor is the lowest postal rates in the world. The second factor is the highest amount, the greatest capacity for paper generation per capita. We have more printers, more fax machines, more personal copiers, more scanners, more of everything, and we generate paper. Our credo has become, I overdo it, therefore I am, or I overcopy, therefore I am, or I over-email, therefore I am. Paper added to the electronic revolution yields a situation where we're besieged at all hours. There are many people who, in addition to getting the same volume of mail and junk mail, the same volume of copies circulated, now, of course, get email on the order of about 190 a day. Increasingly, we're having a higher and higher percentage of spam. Increasingly, people are using email instead of making a call, passing emails back and forth that, you know, one telephone call could take care of, but instead there are 6-8 emails that go back and forth to one another. And we end up getting in the state where we think we can control it all from our desks. The result is ever-increasing anxiety, which I have heard be defined as the attempted unification of opposing forces. So we have to rely on timeless principles. Like babies, we need to learn the basics. Anytime you're hit with a volume of information, like taking water out of a rain barrel, take out a little at a time, a cupful. Don't try to lift that whole barrel and get a drink. The barrel will fall on you or you'll drown. Anytime you get a report, a document, something that you need to review, go through it quickly, copy the key pages, make a dossier out of it, file the larger document someplace. All the scraps around your office, the post-it pads, the business cards, the memos, all of that, sometimes you can boil it down to its essence. Sometimes you can take all those items and lay them on the copier and make a single page out of all those scraps. your wallet, your purse, your briefcase, all those papers, all those notes piling up, they represent unfinished business. They represent decisions you haven't made. At the end of this program today, I want you to slowly and carefully start to go around your office and reclaim your spaces. I want you to take those pages, take those post-it pads, take those business cards, take those notes, take those telephone messages, everything, and start to take control. Add the data to your computer, add it to your palm top, add it to your calendar, make comprehensive rosters, create dossier packets, but take control. I want you also to germinate and reflect. I want you to think about what types of lists you need to be on, what lists you don't need to be on, what documents you probably should be receiving, what documents you don't need to be receiving, what subscriptions you have, both hard copy and online, zines. What subscriptions continue to make sense for you to receive? What subscriptions no longer make sense for you to receive? You see, the clock is ticking. This is the Super Bowl of your life, and nobody is coming around to help you with this stuff. Nobody is coming. You'll see a picture of an aircraft carrier deck, and there's someone on the deck who is getting ready to help a plane land. When I speak to groups in person at conferences, whether it's a keynote, a breakout session, half-day seminar, I sometimes give you this little story. I'll give you the quick version. I ask everyone, how many have seen the movie Top Gun? And almost every hand goes up. I say, okay, in the movie Top Gun, Tom Cruise is flying the friendly skies for the U.S. Navy. Now, when a Navy jet is about to land on an aircraft carrier deck, the term all hands on deck means, traditionally has meant, that everyone picks up a push broom and sweeps that deck as clean and clear as humanly possible. So I ask my audiences why, and somebody invariably gets the answer correct. They say, so that there'll be no debris on the deck, so that the plane has a clear runway. Yes. In other words, you want your plane to have the clearest deck to have the highest probability of a successful landing. Now, today they have blowers and vacuums and all that stuff, but the principle is the same. You want to have the cleanest, clearest deck possible. Now, plane A has already landed and plane B is about to come in for a landing, and A hasn't gotten off the deck out of the landing strip, what's going to happen? B will hit A and they'll crash and burn. Well, your desks, ladies and gentlemen, are like aircraft carrier decks. And if you just park the next pile that comes along in the corner without thinking about it, and then the next pile, and you say to yourself, I'll just put this here and hope the organizing fairy comes by and does something with it. Well, guess what? Nobody is coming. Nobody's going to help you with your desk. It's a do-it-yourself proposition. I'll wait till the laughter dies down here. Okay. Now, if it's been a long time since you've taken a hard look at your desk, your drawers, your shelves, the way you file, what you retain, you're not going to resolve this in 40 minutes or even 40 hours. I want you to tackle a little portion at a time. After today, maybe one half of your desktop. Another time, one half of a file drawer. Why one half of a file drawer? Because if you try to do a four-drawer file cabinet, it will break you. You will be defeated. You will feel frustrated. You will feel as if it's hopeless. You will give up. You won't come back to that file cabinet for maybe months, if at all. But if you'll tackle a half of a drawer, maybe once every 2 weeks, maybe on a Friday when your energy for other things is low, you can actually take control of a whole four-drawer filing cabinet. And then you can start to take control of other parts of your office. You can control your desk drawers. You can control what's on your shelves. But you've got to approach it in a sane and logical manner. You have to approach it when you have the correct energy and a requisite amount of time. If you try to grab off more than you can handle, it will break you. You can't do it. I can't do it. So we turn to the Ten Commandments of Deskmanship. I'll just read them once for amusement and clarity. These work wonders. One, thou shalt clear thy desk every night. Every night, so that when you come in the next morning, you start with a clear, clean desktop, just like a clear, clean landing strip for the aircraft carrier deck. Two, thou shalt continually refine what goes on thy desktop. Three, thou shalt not use thy desktop as a filing cabinet. Four, thou shalt predetermine what is inside thy desk. In other words, you put the things inside the desk that make sense for them to be there, things that you'll use predictably within the course of a week. Now, what goes on top of your desk? Things that you predictably will use in the course of a day. What goes near your desk in shelves or filing on shelves or in filing cabinets? Things that you'll predictably use within a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, or things that you are required to retain because of your job, the law, what have you. All right, moving on. Number five, thou shalt keep 20% of thy drawer space vacant. Why? Why do we want to keep 20% vacant? Well, in a world where more information is generated in less than a second than you could take in the rest of your life, we know that more is coming. We also want to have the maneuverability so that our files are not jammed tight and we hurt ourselves extracting things from the file cabinet. We want to keep this file drawer, as well as our closet drawers, as well as our desks and our shelves, fluid, loose, having some slack, recognizing we live in a dynamic world where information flows in abundance, and so we need to have some space. Number six, thou shalt furnish thy surrounding office to support thy desk. Seven, thou shalt take comfort when at thy desk. Eight, thou shalt keep clean thy desk and thy surrounding areas. A lot of thys here, huh? Nine, thou shalt leave thy desk periodically. Every 20 minutes, from a circulatory system standpoint, you need to get up, walk around, if even just for, 10 seconds. Don't want those blood clots forming. And 10, thou shalt honor thy desk as thyself. Now, about those piles around your room, some of you I can see right now, you've got them around the near the windowsills, on top of the filing cabinet, around the corners of your room. Some of you, it's so bad, coworkers kind of laugh when they come into your office. Sorry, I didn't mean to get personal here. No one can effectively manage horizontal piles. When you stack things up, it's a very bad system because you cannot easily extract what you need. Hence, people put things in filing cabinets. They put them in hot files. They put them arranged on their desk with the labels facing out. Books on a shelf are a perfect filing system because each book has the title on its spine. But if you stack up files, especially in manila or other colored file folders, stacked, it's just a terrible form of management. Temporarily, it's okay. But when that becomes the norm, then I say you've got to break up those piles and allocate where the materials best go. I use an actual stamp when I receive anything in the mail that I don't want to be receiving, and it looks like this is going to be a repeat mailer. I actually have a little stamp that says I don't want my name placed on any mailing list whatsoever and forbid the use, sale, rental, or transfer of my name. And in addition, if I order something, either by filling out a card, by fax, by traditional letter, or online. If I order something online or subscribe to something online, I will place this little caveat on all my communiques as well. I let vendors know in advance that you know, I'm writing or I'm calling or I'm emailing for this particular item, but this is not an invitation, carte blanche, to inundate me for the rest of my life with literature I didn't ask for. I'm not volunteering, to use the Ghostbuster term, I'm not volunteering to be slimed by information that I did not ask for. Okay, a very important notion if you're following along with the slides, don't let your email dictate your priorities. We all can fall into this trap. You get up in the morning, you come into the office, first thing you do is you check your email. Some of it's spam, some of it's crazy, some of it's a friend, some of it's a joke that's been passed along, a handful of things you need to tend to, but we have to recognize that being proactive in determining how your day should go based on objectives, based on goals that you want to accomplish, based on, you know, assignments that have been given to you, is going to prove far more productive than being reactive, deciding I'm going to, you know, deal with this and that based on what came over the email. Clearly, some of what comes via email is important. Unquestionably, this is true. But we have to keep things in context. What were you hired to do? What is your quarterly or monthly or weekly or daily assignment? If you're part of a team, what part do you play? How you best support your team on a daily basis? This comes first. All other forms of communication come second, although indeed we recognize that sometimes the communiques that come in can give you a new set of directives. Now, moving on, here's a magic question. What would it take for me to feel good about ending work today at 5 p.m. or 4:30 or 5:30 or 6 or whatever your normal ending time is? The reason why you ask this question of yourself is so that you achieve what I call a completion, closure to your day. You want to strike a dynamic bargain with yourself. If it's 2:30 in the afternoon and you have 3 items left to take care of, you strike the dynamic bargain and say, okay, if I finish these 3 items by closing time, I will feel good about what I've accomplished today. Now, if someone hands you another assignment and it throws off your 3, then recast your dynamic bargain. Recast the sentence, but still get to that point where you mentally decide what it will take for you to have closure on this day. Then leave and have a life for the rest of the day. If you don't give yourself a sense of closure, you're subject to what's called psychological effect, which in essence says the mind tends to focus more on what is incomplete than what was completed. And so you don't want to leave the office feeling incomplete. And I can tell you that in this era of over-information, time pressure, and stress, it's very easy to leave the office feeling incomplete and bring all that stuff back home with you and then bring it back with you again to work and never let it go. So these are important questions. The second question related to the first is to recognize that you can do the same thing for a Friday afternoon and feel good about the weekend. An overriding principle is this: leaving your desk every night yields a marvelous sense of breathing space to begin the next day. The human mind appreciates closure and a clean ending. The Constitution doesn't say this, but maybe it ought to. People need life, liberty, and the pursuit of completions. Here is the magic sentence for leaving on Friday feeling complete. By the end of work on Friday, what do I want to accomplish so that I can feel good about the weekend? There's a picture of two of my books that encapsulate much of what I'm discussing today, Breathing Space, Living and Working at a Comfortable Pace in a Sped-Up Society, and The Joy of Simple Living. The Joy of Simple Living. Now, sometimes when you're given an assignment or you need to do research on a particular task or project, you need to get an answer, These days, fortunately, the web has very powerful search engines, and many times we can simply type in what we need and immediately get back pretty good results. But we have to understand that more data is not always the answer. The more data you collect, the more often you'll have indicators that say go right and go left. So I say, as often as possible, develop a network within your office and within your industry. Have scouts, have trailblazers, have gurus. These are people who can give you the answers. Suppose you have to learn new software, new technology, new equipment. Your brain is already fried. You're already juggling as much as you can. You don't want to have to crack open another instruction manual. You don't want to have to sit there and suffer and press the wrong keys and end up having all kinds of frustration. There are people in your organization, there are people within your professional societies who've already gone down the same path that you're going down very often. They've already learned that piece of software. They already know how to operate that piece of equipment. So instead of having your brain having to go into this heavy learning mode, you can simply sometimes have somebody come by and give you the five key steps that will solve your problem. It's far more easier to proceed in this world. I actually use college students. Rather than open a manual myself, if I'm putting new software onto my system, I absolutely refuse to read the instruction manual. I won't do it anymore. I don't have that kind of time. I don't have that kind of mental energy. So I use college students who are computer science majors who can come here and in about 5 or 8 minutes figure the whole thing out and then type out a little instruction sheet for me. I save all my little instruction sheets in one master file, and that's it. And when I have to repeat one of these routines, I just pop up that file, read the instructions. Many of them I know by heart by now, but that's it. I use my computer in ways that support me, and I'm not bogged down by all kinds of manuals, directories, documents that would take me hours and hours to go through, and I still wouldn't be doing as well as I'm doing now. I remember Colin Powell's advice when he was general and chairman of the Joint Chiefs back in 1991. He said that if he needed to wait until he had all the data before, let's say in the first Iraq conflict, Persian Gulf conflict, he needed to have all the data. He might be attacked. His troops might be hit. So he would proceed when he felt he was at the 50 or 60% mark. In other words, when he collected about 3/5 of what he might be able to collect, he said that was enough. He'll go forward with that. And more often than not, he was right. In addition to having to collect reams of data before making a decision, we are now, through research, realizing that we have more than one brain. More than one brain, I kid you not. Scientists in the emerging field of neurocardiology have discovered a, quote, brain in the heart, comprised of more than 40,000 neurons of various types, along with a complex network of neurotransmitters, proteins, and support cells. It acts independently of the head. According to Dr. Robert Cooper, this heart brain is as large as many key areas of the thinking brain and sufficiently sophisticated to rate as a brain in its own right. In other words, you see somebody for the first time, you're in your 20s, you fall in love, that's your heart brain working for you. And it isn't as if this is just something pulled out of the air. Gut, instinct, intuition, whatever you want to call it, relies upon cellular intelligence. Every cell in your body since you were born is brought to bear when you make a decision based on instinct. There's much more involved than we ever believed prior to this day. To move on, heartbeats aren't just mechanical pump pulses. They have an intelligent language that influences how we perceive and react to the world. Each and every heartbeat is linked to the thinking brain and affects both branches of the autonomic nervous system, continually influencing our perceptions and awareness. The heart is not only open to new possibilities, it actively scans for them, ever seeking new intuitive understanding. Now that's the brain that the heart offers to us. Now, pioneering research by physiologists and gastroenterologists indicate that there is also a brain in the intestines, known as the enteric nervous system. It is independent of and interconnected with the brain in the cranium, according to Dr. Michael Gershon. Gut instincts are real and worth listening to. So we have a brain in our heads, a brain in our hearts, and a brain in our intestines, if you will. All of them work to serve us in ways sometimes that we're not even aware. So we can get to decisions faster. We don't have to necessarily take in so much information. That's great, great news. Now, decisions in record-making time. You use your second and third brain. You use your intuition. And here's a way to gently get into usage. Suppose you have to buy a piece of equipment for your company, or suppose you have to choose between plan A and plan B. First, look over the piece of equipment or plan A and plan B and write down your decision based on instinct. Write it down, say why, put it in a drawer, and forget about it. Now go ahead and collect all the data that you would normally collect in order to make an informed decision. Maybe this takes days, maybe it takes weeks. Finally, go ahead, you make your decision, and you get to see the results of your decision. Find that piece of paper that you filed away so meticulously, see what it says, and see if your intuitive decision at first matched the decision you came up with after you collected reams of information. And you know the amazing thing? More times than you might guess, in fact, pretty close to all the time, you probably will have gotten the right answer right at the outset. Now, I'm not saying to be reckless, and I'm not saying to abandon, you know, time-honored traditions within your organizations, and I'm not saying that there aren't some decisions that require very precise information. Of course, all that comes up. But I'm saying a lot more than we know. We don't have to be collecting reams of information before proceeding. William James, the philosopher, said, "The art of being wise is the art of knowing what to overlook." Now, here's a personal technique I use to not be inundated by all that I want to compete. And you can imagine, after speaking to more than 750 groups, after writing more than 30 books, my files are flowing. I have voluminous files. I have a lot of information in my life and in my career, as much as any of you out there, really, truly. What I do is I create what I call a super to-do list. The super to-do list contains everything that I want to get done in this world, all in one file. The first page of the list represents the short-term items or the short-term portion of long-term tasks or projects that I've moved up to the front. But on any given day, I only have to look at the first page. What the super to-do list does for me is help me to have low anxiety about everything I want or need to accomplish, because it's all in one list, one file on my computer, which I print out on a regular basis as I update it. You can do variations on the theme. You can do this on a palm top. You can do this just hard copy, any way you want. The point is, when you consider putting everything you want to accomplish in one master file, I think you have a real good chance to having your anxiety die down. The Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh says, "If I am incapable of washing dishes joyfully, if I want to finish them quickly so I can go and have dessert, I will be equally incapable of enjoying my dessert. If I am incapable of washing dishes joyfully, with the fork in my hand, I will be thinking about what to do next, and the texture and the flavor of the dessert, together with the pleasure of eating, will be lost. I will always be dragged into the future, never able to live in the present moment. I say, when you acknowledge the over-information era in which we live, the onslaught of paper and email and communications and choices competing for your time and attention, and decide slowly and carefully to reclaim your space, starting with your desk, your file cabinets, your drawers, and then list everything on your super to-do list so that it's all in one place. Recognize the power of your intellect as well as your intuition. You have a much better chance of proceeding, a much better chance of getting out at the end of the day feeling good about what you've accomplished. Use the dynamic questions at the end of the day and the end of the week, and have a life at the end of the day. Have a life over the weekend. When you control the spaces in your life, control of your time in life tend to follow.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's presentation. Feel free to give us a call with your comments, or if you prefer, you may fax or email our office. If you are serious about profitable growth, you might want to consider attending one of our 3-day basic business boot camps. Check out our website at www.grandyassociates.com or call us at 1-800-432-7963 for a current listing of the dates and locations through May 2009. The Service Contractors Business Presentation of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.